Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Amwha Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amwha Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. As always, as every single episode, we have a great guest for you today. Of course, I'm talking about Bruce Klingner, who is senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and has a, if you want to know more, we'll post it on the web and you can see his great bio, but he's a South Korea, North Korea expert. And we've talked once before a year or so ago about all the goings on that, after the Washington Declaration and in that time since we talked last, there's been a lot that's gone on. The Biden administration, they agreed to the Washington Declaration and then they moved forward. And so they've been slowly but surely working through all of those issues, sending submarines to South Korea, doing all those things to assure the South Koreans. And then now here we are. We just had a NATO summit meeting and President Yoon was here. And so Bruce is back so we can talk about where we stand today. So welcome back to NucleCast.
Well, thanks for having me again. I'm glad to be back.
So tell us about what has gone on here recently and sort of where we've started and come from over the last year.
Well, I think what we have is much greater U.S. transparency and South Korea feeling much more reassured. But perhaps the jury is still out on how things will play out, given changes with the North Korean threat, as well as potential changes in U.S. administrations and policy. So what I was struck by was when I was in Korea back in late 2022, early 2023, after not being able to be there because of COVID, was really the whole South Korea going nuclear had shifted from a fringe discussion of many years to very mainstream. And in conferences in late 2022, early 2023, fueled in part by President Yoon's two misstatements or deliberate misstatements of South Korea may need to go nuclear, it really became obvious that this could be an issue that could strain the alliance and the overall relationship. So many of us came back from meetings in Korea kind of telling the U.S. administration that, hey, folks, this just when we thought the alliance was in perfect shape, this could be a major problem. And then just a few short months later, we had the Washington Declaration. And some of the South Korean officials that I met with in January of 2023, who were, kind of very grumpy and dissatisfied with the lack of U.S. transparency, were now being very effusive in the change in U.S. policies. So kind of a remarkable change in just a few months. And President Yoon went from hinting that South Korea may go down the nuclear path to very firmly affirming South Korea's adherence to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and not going nuclear. And then since then, we've had the process continuing to go on, and both U.S. and South Korean officials seem quite pleased with it. Outsiders, sort of Korean experts or public, may not be as satisfied, but the South Korean government seems quite satisfied.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch because I periodically talk to South Koreans about, these nuclear issues. And one of the things that has struck me is that there's a pretty low level of knowledge and understanding of, all things nuclear. And then, I've watched how we the U.S. are trying to, provide education for them and do some other things. And I don't really see the level going up dramatically. It's going from, very little to some. But for example, in terms of the South Koreans understanding how we or they or we as an alliance would have to fight through a nuclear battlefield. and, you know, the many technical issues that you have to engage in, and, you know, how does a maneuver element operate, you know, in and around, you know, a zone where an employment of a nuclear weapon is taking place. I don't see anything like that. Do you see this as sort of, is it still just immature in its development and that we'll eventually get there? Or do you think that our plan is to never sort of, you know, we're sort of still holding back and reticent to really give the South Koreans a lot of understanding of sort of nuclear issues and nuclear employment and sort of all of those things that come with it?
Well, you put a lot on the table. I think, you know, in talking with U.S. officials, there's, you know, initially almost a disdainful attitude of, you know, the Koreans don't know anything. This is all very, very super, super secret. You know, we can't let them know anything. To, you know, being more forthcoming. And the first step, as they sort of indicated, was, you know, trying to educate folks who have never really had access to any kind of nuclear planning to, you know, a totally new topic, almost like, I don't know, probably a bad analogy, but like bringing a grade school student into a graduate class. And it's, you know, just kind of overwhelming because it's theories and practices that have just never been, you know, shared. And, you know, the U.S., I think, sees itself as being much, much more forthcoming, sort of a, look, we're doing, you know, actual classes on nuclear strategy, policy, employment, et cetera. We're doing tabletop exercises, you know, a number of other things that have never been done, but it has to be kind of a slow process just in order to, again, get that, you know, elementary school student up to graduate level. Whereas the Koreans, I think within the government now, there seems to be like, you know, this is great. You know, this, we are very happy. And yes, we understand it takes a long time. But where kind of the friction might be is either down the road, if the government says, you know, we don't feel like the U.S. is living up to what we thought they would do, or this isn't enough, we always want more, or if the Korean government sort of overstates what the relationship is, or on the nuclear issue is. So last year, the Deputy National Security Advisor for Korea, you know, said some things describing the agreement, and, you know, a senior NSC official had to come out publicly and sort of say, that's not really the case. And recently President Yoon made some statements which seemed to be over dramatizing or over claiming what the agreement is. So that could be a cause for friction. And then sort of outside of government, you still have the elites or the general public still clamoring for nuclear weapons or redeployment of U.S. nukes onto the peninsula. Kind of every time North Korea does something, or every time there seems to be a hiccup in the U.S.-South Korean relationship. And proponents for Korea going nuclear, you know, always sort of cite the 70% or higher public approval rating for going nuclear. And many of us have tried to point out that, you know, if you look behind those surveys, the actual support is much lower, particularly once an interviewer starts pointing out the risks and consequences that would happen in South Korea if they went nuclear. And then the approval goes down, sometimes down to, you know, 38% or so. So, like I said, I think on the government level, things are going much more smoothly. The Korean government seems much happier. And Seoul has said, you know, we're not going nuclear. So kind of enough, you know, there's the issue closed. There are still kind of clamors on the outside for South Korea having some greater nuclear role or an indigenous program.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, because as I think about it, as somebody who spent his, you know, career in the nuclear enterprise, and I look at exactly what we're doing, and then, you know, thinking about, you know, nuclear employment against a North Korean use, sort of the weapons and systems allocated to Korea are never the ones I would, you know, willfully pick for that. I think they're sort of, right. you know, submarines are terrible weapons to respond to, a Trident D5 is not a good weapon to respond to a low yield North Korean use. And so I wonder at some point, will the sort of the South Koreans have a level of understanding where they're putting, you know, weapons and systems and sort of figuring it out for themselves? You know, they're standing up their own strategic command. They're, you know, maybe they get to the point where they're like, hey, you know what the Americans are telling us they're going to do is not really an optimal approach. And therefore they start, you know, sort of poking and saying, hey, wait a second, you know, what would really be better for, you know, this scenario on the pen is if we had this capability, not this capability. And I sort of wonder, cause those are the things that I think about and sort of, as I play them out and, you know, I talk to South Koreans and say, Hey, have you thought about this? Is this something you're considering, and have you ever sort of mapped out how things might actually go down and what you might need to respond to them? So as you sort of play through this, you know, we sort of think through them, you know, that's, we don't have a lot of experience with nuclear conflict, so therefore a lot of it's, you know, it's mental math and you know, mind games. But is your thought and sort of you're talking to people, what's your sort of sense of where the discussion and the thought level are in terms of, you know, beyond just the sort of the high theoretical, you know, a nuclear weapon could get used, but where you actually map it out and what it might look like and how you would respond and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think the way I might describe it is there's kind of three levels, kind of in front of the curtain, you know, with the public, just behind the curtain where, you know, U.S. and Korean officials will kind of talk to those of us who work the issue, who have been in government, you know, they'll be a bit more forthcoming on what's going on. And then kind of way behind the curtain where the actual kind of nuclear practitioners are operating. So in front of the curtain, you know, it's the government is sort of saying, look, this is always going to be a case of trust me. We can't tell you the intricacies of this stuff because it is really sensitive. What I was struck by was when I've talked to some former, you know, U.S. commanders on the peninsula, the four stars, they were saying, look, I didn't know what the nuke plan was. And I'm like, oh my God, sir, you're a four-star general. You are in charge of the war plan, et cetera. And they're like, yeah, you know, I didn't interact with STRATCOM. They didn't really tell me what was going on. I would have to defer to, you know. So it's just kind of amazing, and, you know, whether that's changed over the years or not. And then something else was, you know, a U.S. official was saying, look, even the Assistant Secretary of Defense for East Asia doesn't know the op plan for the nuclear weapons. And I was pretty shocked by that, too. So it does show how incredibly sensitive and tightly controlled, you know, that those discussions are, even within the U.S. government. So there's always going to be a bit of, you know, you read these joint statements, and especially when it comes to nuclear weapons, it's very bland. It's a lot of, you know, trust me, things are going well. And if you have both governments saying it, it's like, well, I guess they are. And they'll kind of talk about tabletop exercises and education classes and, you know, other things, which are all, you know, kind of amorphous. And, you know, just like with intelligence matters, I can read between the lines, you know, like about imagery or intelligence sources and, you know, understand things better than the general public. And you and other, you know, former nuclear practitioners, I'm sure, can read statements and kind of like, oh, okay, that's what this means to a much greater degree than others of us. You know, and then behind the curtain, they'll tell us things and, you know, but it's still a trust me, because they'll say, look, you know, I am a Korean official. I'm very happy. We're doing a lot of good things. It's like, okay, I don't understand what it is, but I'm feeling better that you're reassured. And then obviously when you go into the deep expertise, folks who would, you know, would almost have to still be in the room to see what is that tabletop exercise? How good is it? How realistic? So it's, I think, levels of understanding, but unless we're in the room, you know, during an actual nuclear consultative group meeting or the working group meetings, we still don't know what's going on, and we still have to have that level of trust me.
Yeah. So do you think that there is, and this, the way I read it is that there's a fear among South Koreans that if they were to build an indigenous program, they fear retaliation from the U.S., you know, sanctions, whatever, and that would hurt the South Korean economy. And the South Korean economy and its continued growth is sort of their main focus. And that's their big scare. Do you read it that way? Or do you think there's a whole bunch of other, you know, concerns, fears at play?
Well, I think with any ally, there's always the concurrent fears of entanglement and abandonment. So, you know, I've worked Korea for several decades now, and Korea does seem to be kind of the needy ally of, you know, sure, you had a military exercise with us, but that was last week. You know, are you still going to defend me? And that's sort of gone forward over the decades. So, you know, every time North Korea does something, there may be a fear of, would the U.S. really be here? And, you know, since I think particularly 2017, when North Korea tested an ICBM that could range, you know, all of the U.S., the fear of, would you really trade San Francisco for Seoul has really grown. And many of us have kind of pointed out that, well, during the Cold War, we were willing to risk New York, Washington, and San Francisco for Bonn, Paris, and London. Why would you not trust us? And then they can come back of, yes, but the UK and France went nuclear, et cetera. And there are a lot of reasons for why they did that beyond fear of U.S. abandonment or not fulfilling our treaty obligation. So there is that ever-present concern about abandonment. If a U.S. official or former official or potentially future official says something, that can spike concern as well. So I think there has been this growing fear of, would we really risk our own cities to nuclear attack once North Korea has developed that capability, which we think they've had for a number of years. So it is, I think, the concern of abandonment that has really been exacerbated in recent years.
So it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. And so we'll be right back, and we're having a great conversation with Bruce Klingner, and just stick with us.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrent Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back. And so my next follow, I want to posit an option, and you tell me if this is good, bad, and why either way. So I'll throw out to you that South Korea needs to become a participant in, you know, nuclear, in the nuclear world. It needs to build its own arsenal. Of course, that means Japan will build its own arsenal as well. And so these are allies, strong allies, much like the French and the British. And they will, in much as the French and the British complicate any Russian effort to, you know, think through how to use nuclear weapons against NATO, a South Korean and a Japanese arsenal will do the same thing for China and have the potential to give China reason for pause in any kind of conflict, because a Taiwan conflict will likely bring the Japanese and the South Koreans in. And so therefore, a nuclear Japan and South Korea is a good thing that deters China. Is that good idea, bad idea? Why?
I don't think it's a good idea. And again, okay, you put a lot on the table. and so kind of on the one hand, some people might say, look, if you think in terms of like a old Wild West movie, you know, if the sheriff and the posse are going after the bad guys, don't you want all the you know, the other guys in the posse to have weapons and the best weapons possible. And it's like, well, yeah, that seems to make sense. And when it comes to nuclear weapons, it's a lot different. And kind of getting back to a point you raised before of, you know, the economic impact. So some South Koreans will say, look, the U.S. is never going to sanction South Korea. We're a very trusted ally, et cetera, et cetera. Well, but it's a number of things that would happen automatically. So if South Korea said, look, we're going down the nuclear path, the nuclear suppliers group, which provides all of South Korea's fissile material for its civilian nuclear program, which accounts for 30 some percent of South Korea's total electricity, would by their own rules have to automatically cut off fissile material provision to South Korea. South Korea could drain all of its nuclear reactors for fuel for weapons, but then they've just lost 30% of their electricity production. And you think of what, you know, the impact on their economy would be. Also, the nuclear civilian nuclear sales to foreign nations, which is a big industry for Seoul, would also halt. Also, if South Korea went nuclear, some have said that's an alliance breaker. Back in the 1970s, when South Korea had a covert program, the U.S. made very clear that that would be an alliance breaker. Whether that would be the case now or not, we don't know. But if they were to test a weapon, which you would think they would have to do to prove that they have a viable deterrent, there's U.S. laws that would require automatically, without presidential waiver ability, that we would have to cut off economic and military assistance to South Korea. So there would be a major impact, even without sort of active U.S. new sanctions or U.N. sanctions. So there would be a major impact, and then proliferation and all that. But so I think there would be an impact on South Korea. And then also if South Korea said, okay, today we're going nuclear, but it's going to take a while. And if the U.S. said, I'm sorry, you're on your own, then there's that window where they have lost the U.S. extended deterrence guarantee before they have their own. And clearly it would be quite a while before they developed a capability equal to even a limited U.S. extended capability. So there would be quite a window of vulnerability, which might encourage North Korea to be more provocative. So I think right now many of us see that the nuclear consultative group is a way of bringing in Korea to reassure them, but they know that the final decision to use nuclear weapons will always be in the U.S. hands, which makes some of them nervous that if we decide not to fulfill our treaty obligations, then that leaves them very vulnerable. So there's a lot of discussion amongst Korea watchers, although I think there's less of it now than, say, a year ago when it seemed to be more of an alliance crisis.
Well, then, so let's say I say, man, you're right, Bruce, you know, that's a bad idea. Well, let's take the middle path. And that middle path is a return of U.S. nuclear weapons to the peninsula. You know, we'll bring F-35s with B-61-12s to Kunsan, or maybe we'll have some LRSO, because LRSO is on track and on budget, so we can easily convert LRSO to Glickum. So we'll bring some, you know, this new version of Glickum, and you know, it's going to be great. That solves all the problems there. You know, the Korea's happy, the North Koreans are deterred, America's proved it's a good alliance member. The Chinese are now looking at, man, what are the Americans going to do? Is that really pointed at us? And so it's great. What do you say?
Well, I have questions. The first questions would be, how does that deter North Korea more than our existing capabilities? If we have said, look, if you cross the nuclear line, that's the end of your regime, which may or may not mean we use nuclear weapons. I think the South Koreans some of them want a look, even if they use the smallest tactical nuclear weapon and only take out a tank battalion, we want you to nuke Pyongyang. I mean, some have said that. They kind of want an automatic nuke for nuke. the U.S. may say, look, if we can accomplish the mission without using nukes, why not do that? You know, put a JDAM through Kim Jong-un's window or something. But so the question might be, how does having nukes on peninsula deter North Korea more than, you know, kind of the who knows where the nukes are out in the water or, you know, in a crisis, we can put, you know, nukes on target in 30 minutes. Or if there's a buildup to a crisis, we could start flowing things to the peninsula or Guam or Okinawa, et cetera. Why do you need them there now? Other considerations would be if you put nukes on peninsula, isn't that a big target of hit me first? Like a lot of really important strategic you know, assets are right there in a very easy to find bunker. Wouldn't that be the target that North Korea would go after first? And perhaps they are more likely to target it because it's there, either in a crisis or if they perceive or misperceive that the U.S. or South Korea is about to attack. And then something else would be, how would the South Koreans react to that deployment? Or, you know, remember back in 2016, 2017, with the THAAD defensive missile system deployment, which led to huge protests in South Korea over a defensive system, you know, how would they feel about having nukes, you know, in their neighborhood? That could, you know, and the U.S. can't do it without South Korean acquiescence. So would the Yoon administration reverse itself, or would a future administration reverse itself? And could the protests and the resistance lead to greater strains in the relationship rather than improving it?
Yeah. Okay. So I'll take that back to everybody in South Korea and we'll talk through it and we'll make a decision on what we want to do. Okay. So unfortunately we're getting to the end, which means I'm going to bring out Bob the Genie.
Oh,
rub my magic lamp. And as you know, Bob grants you three wishes. They just have to be on the topics we've discussed. So Bruce, let me ask you, what is your first wish?
I can't say a bottle of 18-year-old single malt scotch.
Well, I think that's everybody's wish, okay. But right. We'll assume that one and we'll see, you know, we'll throw that on the side for Bob to work right. on. But,
it's sort of getting to the nuclear issue, but more generally, I would say I would want the U.S. to continually affirm its commitment to the treaty, all of our obligations, maintain our current force levels on the peninsula, not make any statements that indicate their continued deployment is conditional on, you know, reimbursement costs, or that we may move them elsewhere to deal with the Taiwan contingency, et cetera. So I think that really the greatest source of reassurance to the allies is that we will keep our word, that we have treaty obligations, we have, you know, 70 years of history, et cetera, that we will live up to our commitment. I'm hoping that will go a long way. And then along with that is, in a lot of ways, more of the same, that we continue down being more forthcoming in the nuclear consultative group process, that we include South Korea to a greater extent than we have in the past in nuclear planning. Now, I know defense officials who really know this stuff will say, look, there's different levels and that we can't bring them into certain inner circles. Like, okay, that's beyond my level of comprehension, but to the degree possible. And then also focus a lot on the conventional nuclear integration, which I think is a big focus for Korea, deciding whether their strategic command, what its role is with U.S. Forces Korea, with U.S. Strategic Command, et cetera. So I think we're on a good path, and I think we just need to affirm it and continue going down that path. And then if there are glitches that are down the road, then we have to deal with them, you know, very quickly and in a mutually consultative manner.
Okay, so that only counts as one wish. So that was one wish. Now you've got three of them.
Oh,
and
man,
and Bob doesn't Bob doesn't take wishes lightly. So,
man, God, I was hoping that was about four or five. I counted as six, and it included, you know, my next broadcast with you. I would hope that, and this is getting off the nuclear topic, but that the current and future South Korean administrations continue the path set by President Yoon of improving relations with Japan, as well as much greater security cooperation on a bilateral basis, as well as trilaterally with the U.S., and that it's shielded from kind of the vagaries of South Korean public opinion. You know, if a Japanese politician says something wrong, that it doesn't derail the whole process. So that is very necessary for deterring North Korea. And that would also incorporate the UN command sending states, or now they're called member nations, that I think we need, as the UN administration has done, greater acknowledgement of the importance of UNC and the member states. I think greater involvement by the member states in military exercises, and there's been some of that, either individually as predominantly European sending member states, or kind of collectively a UN command-led exercise that incorporates provisions and involvement by the member states. And the third would be South Korea continuing its timidly implemented so far pledge to assume a greater security role in the region, particularly when it comes to Taiwan. Seoul has been very reticent to call out Beijing or Moscow kind of by name for their transgressions. They've been kind of timid in responding to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Yoon keeps, you know, moving the goalposts on what would it require Russia to do for South Korea to provide direct lethal aid to Ukraine. And, you know, with the focus on China in the East China Sea, South China Sea, Taiwan, South Korea, I think, has been talking a bit of a big game, but not really following through on what would you do in a Taiwan contingency.
It does seem that the South Koreans care so much about their economy and their continued prosperity, which, you know, I care about the American economy and prosperity. Who doesn't? But, you know, they saw when the Chinese, you know, punished them over the radar deployment to South Korea. And they're like, man, that was kind of a small thing. You know, a bigger thing, what might the Chinese do? And how could that, you know, essentially tank the South Korean economy? But I have wondered, so I understand, you know, the South Koreans say, you know, Adam, we're the Israel of East Asia. You know, we're the small country. There's big, big angry countries around us. You know, we need, you know, this is in reference to why they need their own nuclear weapons. You know, we're like the Israelis. We need our own weapons because, you know, you know how bad the Chinese are, and you know what the Japanese did to us. And so I sort of get that. So I've wondered why they don't sort of take an Israeli approach, which is oftentimes, you know, the Israelis have never declared themselves a nuclear power. Everybody knows it. But why don't they sort of follow the Israeli model of, you know, the Israelis do lots. I mean, they've got great relations with a lot of Arab states, but it's sort of under the table stuff. And I wonder why the South Koreans are not, you know, take their fears of the Chinese and the ramifications of economic stuff, but do a lot under the table. Is that happening?
No, I don't think so. And they would remember what happened in the 1970s when they did try that. The U.S. made very clear that it was an alliance breaker. You know,
but I mean, just in terms of other things like their support for Ukraine or,
right,
you know, all these other things, maybe don't do it publicly, but do it, you know, quietly.
Yeah, and you know, when it comes to Ukraine, you know, President Yoon gave a speech in Kyiv, sort of equating the international support for defending Ukraine to the international support to defending Korea in 1950 to 1953. And, you know, kind of my response was, well, sir, you know, what if North Korea attacked again and the international community said, oh, that you're in a conflict zone, we're not allowed to provide aid. And, you know, China would be very angry if we responded, and we wouldn't want to have to, you know, get involved in a conflict with China. So point. You're on your own. It's like, well, sir, you know, if you're going to talk big, you need to follow through. Now, people will say, look, Bruce, hundreds of thousands of South Korean artillery rounds are making it into Ukraine via Poland and the U.S. You know, do you really need them to publicly tweak the, you know, the Russian bear's tail? Can't you just be happy with, you know, under the table support? And that's a good point. And similarly with China, Korea has been diversifying away its business away from South Korea to reduce China's ability to economically twist their arm. And South Korea has been more involved in Southeast Asia, et cetera, with military maritime domain awareness, helping Southeast Asian nations. Again, Bruce, can't you just be happy that they're doing it under the table? Do you really need them to tweak the Chinese dragon's tail? And again, that's a good point. But I tend to be more in favor of, you know, calling out transgressions by name and sort of standing up for the principles that they are espousing. And, you know, I think that would increase deterrence if they say, yeah, we will have a role in a Taiwan contingency. And then whether they define it clearly or not, it shows China that, yeah, there'd be more nations that they would have to face.
Yeah, it's a fair point. You know, we could talk about this for several more hours, but, you know, we pride ourselves on being, you know, just long enough of a podcast to listen on your way to or from work. And so we'll stop here. So, of course, Bruce Klingner, thanks for joining us, senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And, you know, go read Bruce's, go to Heritage and keyword search Bruce and read what he's writing on South Korea. He writes really good stuff, really informative. So thanks for being on NucleCast. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks very much. And yeah, if your listeners are commuting in Washington, they could listen to a very long podcast. If they're stuck on the beltway. But thanks again for having me.
True enough. And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast, and we'll see you next time. It's always good to talk to Bruce. You know, he's one of those guys who knows Korea well. He stays involved. You know, he's in Korea several times a year, talks to the right people, knows all the right folks. And so he's got a good sense of what's going on and, you know, who's doing what and who thinks what. And so getting an update from Bruce on, you know, where we've come over the last year or so, it's, you know, it's always useful and informative.
This has been a production of the Anwa Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.